session number 29428, Reel 2.
Right, Jim, from North Africa, you're on your way to...
We went to the invasion at Salerno in Italy. This was probably the worst period that the regiment had during the war. The beaches were completely overlooked by the Germans, who were some miles inland. The area was crisscrossed by ditches full of water, malarial mosquitoes, and so life wasn't extremely pleasant. I did contract malaria there, although I didn't feel it until a month or so later.
Okay. So that was a bad time, sir?
Yes. As a matter of fact, at one point we got back on our landing craft and landed a few miles farther up the coast. Now, the American Rangers had been in before us, and so that was an unopposed landing. And then we sailed off over the hills and down into Naples and then northwards towards the river Volturno.
Right. So from sad story, but there was just a funny little story here that happened. One of your troopers was captured, wasn't he?
Yes. One amusing little tale I remember from my Italian days. A trooper named Slade, a Cockney, had been captured when his tank was knocked out, but then managed to escape. And on returning to the regiment, he told this little story. He was interviewed by a German intelligence officer who said, "Ah, we know the names of every officer in the Scots Greys, but we're having a little difficulty with the name of your commanding officer. Or were you commanded by a committee? Because his name sounds something like Twistleton Wycombe Fiennes." Slade said, "Ah, yes, we had lots of difficulties with that name too, but to us he was known as Lugs."
As you proceeded over the hills from Naples in your Bren carrier, you were with Captain the Honourable John Warriner, weren't you?
Yes, I was serving that then, not in a tank, but in a Bren carrier, an awful little vehicle that was always breaking down and would barely stop us, a rifle bullet. My commander was Lieutenant the Honourable John Warriner. We halted just before the Volturno. He said, "Jump out, Randall, and put a brew on." I said, "I'm feeling bloody awful, sir. Let Fletcher do it." He was the driver.
He wasn't happy with that.
No, he wasn't. He said, "I'll soon find out how ill you are," and marched me down to the medical officer's half track and said, "Take this man's temperature." This the doctor did, and it was well over 100, and I was put into an ambulance and sent away with malaria. That was the only time that I was away from the regiment during the whole of the war. I soon found myself lying on a stretcher on the concrete floor of a warehouse. That was my first hospitalization. But very soon afterwards, I found myself in a proper military hospital in Naples.
This was with the 15th Scottish Hospital?
This was called the 15th Scottish Hospital.
What happened after hospital?
By the time I came out of hospital, I was sent back to the regiment, which took several days to accomplish. The regiment had been then given orders to return to the UK with General Montgomery for the Normandy affair. And he had decided to take some of his so-called battle-hardened regiments with him. In January 1944, I found myself sailing up the Clyde. I had been abroad for 4 years, but many of my Scots companions hadn't seen Bonnie Scotland for 6 years. We were transported down to the south coast to a place called Worthing, and that is where we prepared for the Normandy landings.
Okay, you're back in the UK, but not for long.
No. We did some practice, getting on and off tank landing craft, but on D-Day, I found myself being very seasick in mid-channel. We didn't land until D-Day plus one, and so we had an unopposed landing. A couple of days later, I received my first stripe and was put in command of a light reconnaissance tank.
You found yourself fairly soon in difficult country again for tanks, didn't you?
Yes, the Normandy bocage, as it was called, consisted of lots of small fields with tall hedges around them, and you had very little outlook, which a tank really needs. It was very close country for tank warfare. I remember one little amusing incident when I was returning to Liga at last night with my commander, my troop officer. We were going through a cornfield and spotted several Germans ducking down among the corn. My officer got in a terrible tangle with his case and something else he'd got hanging round his neck. He couldn't get out of his tank very quickly. But we soon rounded up the Germans, and they were the first prisoners the regiment took in Normandy.
You used the Browning quite a bit, didn't you?
Yes.
How did you get on with that?
I found the Browning an excellent gun. In our light tanks, we had a 37mm with a Browning mounted in parallel to it, but up on the top of the turret where I sat, I had another Browning, which was supposed to be for ACAC firing, but I used that one quite a lot.
Must be pretty noisy in that tin box of yours, wouldn't it?
Very noisy inside the tank, it was indeed, yes.
One eventful day whilst in Normandy.
Hill 112, as it was called, was a very unpleasant place to be. I went up with my tank at first light one morning, and in the semi-light and semi-darkness, I saw lots of infantrymen lying on the hillside, which I thought were sleeping, but on closer acquaintance, I saw they were all dead. They had been killed in the battle on the previous day. It was an unpleasant place in many respects. I remember one particular moment, you might say, when a dead German was lying outside my tank. I remember him because he was the only red-haired German I ever saw. And every time a shell landed nearby, it blew him up into the air and he sailed over my turret looking more ragged every moment. We were closed into Normandy for about 3 months, but eventually we broke out and advanced eastwards across France, Belgium, Holland and Germany. Mm. Because I was recce troop corporal by then, I was often the leading tank, and I remember going down the street of a little French village. There was one civilian hurrying down. I pulled my tank over beside him, and in my schoolboy French, I said something like this: "Bonjour, monsieur. Où sont les Boches aujourd'hui?" He said, "Vous êtes Américain?" I said, "No, Anglais." He said, "I want to show you." And he got on my tank and took me to the other end of the village where dozens of German horse transport were parked. They had lots of horse transport still in their army in those days. And we shot a few of them up. I chased the commanding officer on his grey horse across country, but very luckily he got away from me.
Okay. Before we leave France, there's something that stuck in your mind, I know, the Falaise Gap.
Yes. The Falaise Gap, as it was called, was a very, very unpleasant place to be. We were coming down from the north. The Americans were coming up from the south, and so the German army trapped between us had a very small bottleneck through which to escape, and the RAF were having a field day. The roads were lined with dead horses, dead Germans. The fields were full of dead cattle, and the stench was very, very unpleasant.
There's nothing you could do for the animals then?
No. I remember my troops officer, Captain Sprott, trying to put one of the horses out of its agony by firing his pistol somewhere between its eyes. But as he said in her book, which he wrote later, the poor animal just blinked at me.
Okay. So the Royal Scots Greys now make their way slowly into Belgium. Germans are in retreat.
Yeah. Right. We followed up the retreating Germans through Belgium. One little incident sticks in my mind. We had had a brush with the German rear guard in the afternoon, and that night we leaguered in a little Belgian town. I was lying in my blankets on the cobblestones beside my tank. I had been given orders to advance at first light the next morning to try to make contact with the enemy. And, like a good recce troop NCO, I was studying my map. I saw the name of the town in which we were staying the night. It was Oudenarde. And I immediately remembered that it was one of the regiment's battle honours. They had fought a battle there 200 years previously, riding their grey horses under the command of the Duke of Marlborough in the War of the Spanish Succession. And there we were, 200 years later, not riding grey horses, but in American tanks.
So soldiers are taught regimental history.
It was indeed regimental history at its best.
Still in Belgium, you have contact with a young officer just out of Sandhurst, and perhaps a little green behind the ears, called Lieutenant Lord John Althorp.
When we had returned from Italy, we received quite a number of reinforcements, both officers and other ranks. And one of our new officers was the Honourable John Althorp, who later in life became the father of Princess Diana. He was a gallant gentleman, but a very poor map reader. And I remember on patrol one particular day, going very slowly around a bend in a lane, seeing a tank heavily camouflaged coming towards me. I thought it was an enemy tank and I was going to quickly be shot up, but it proved to be the Honourable John Althorp, completely lost.
So you could have changed the course of history then?
I could indeed.
Althorp loved collecting weapons, didn't he?
Yes. He had an obsession with collecting enemy weapons, and he had them all over his tank. In fact, his driver, who was a little Lancastrian, nicknamed Snacker, got so fed up with him, saying, "What do we want all these bloody weapons for on the tank? We've got our own." He was very, very displeased.
We'll come to Snacker later about something else, but we've sort of moved on a little bit now into Holland, and I know that you were at a crossing point by two canals crossing.
That is so. We advanced eventually through Holland, and I reached a point where two of their big canals formed a crossroads. And I occupied that position until last light. The next day, another sergeant in my tank took his section down to occupy the same position and was immediately killed by a sniper. And so I had to go down and take over his section. At the same time as that happened, we had a troop of Shermans not far away on the left of that position, overlooking the canal, because the Germans were in houses on the eastern side of the canal. They mortared the Shermans, and a young officer who had only been with us one day and an old pal of mine from Palestine days were both killed there, and I attended their burial the next day.
Going back to Lord Althorp's driver, he'd been a butcher, hadn't he?
Yes.
In civilian life,
Lord Althorp's driver had been a butcher. And we were resting on a German farm a period later, where we killed a pig, Snatcher butchered it, and from then on, every tank in recce troop had a lump of pork hanging from the breech block inside the tank. There were Canadians on the same farm, and there was great rivalry collecting eggs. In fact, if you waited for them to be laid, you would be too late. And so we chased the hens and squeezed the eggs out of them.
Back in Holland, though, there was a very hard winter at that time, wasn't it, 1944?
The winter of 1944 was a very hard winter. The war came to an end. We were billeted on a little Dutch farm, sleeping on the concrete floor of his barn. And nothing of a military nature was taking place, because the war came to a halt for several months. Being a Scots regiment, on January the 1st, which is called Hogmanay, we organised a cross-country race, 5 miles across the frozen fields. I led for the first 4 miles, and then was passed by a little reinforcement chap whose name I didn't even know.
What an insult. You saw the first German jet plane, didn't you?
On that particular day, while I was running in that race, I saw the first German jet plane streaking across the sky.
I remember you saying in the Dutch village Zomeren, you were entertained well by Dutch farmers.
Yes. As I say, we slept on a Dutch farm for a couple of months before the war started up again, and we moved on eastwards.
It was so cold though, wasn't it?
Very cold indeed, very cold. I was sleeping in my two blankets underneath a strip of tarpaulin, which every tank had, and it used to freeze solid every night.
Didn't the Americans only burn the barn down?
Well, in fact, one of our troops, Sherman troops, who were living in a Dutch barn at the other end of the village, built a big fire to keep warm and unfortunately burnt the barn down.
Okay. There was a time, actually, when you were near the canal, I think you were coming back to camp, it was so foggy you couldn't see where you were going, or the driver couldn't. What did you do about that?
Well, I remember on this particular night returning to Liga in a very, very thick fog, driving along the canal bank. My driver could scarcely see a yard in front of him, so I went into a bombed-out Dutch house, removed a sheet from one of the beds, and walked along the canal bank, holding the sheet out wide so that he didn't drive into the canal.
Somebody was a sheet missing then.
He said, yes, but there wasn't much less of the house from which I had removed the sheet.
As the regiment progressed, you had to cross the River Rhine.
Yes.
Yes.
We eventually reached the banks of the Rhine. I was sitting up on the turret of my tank when the airborne forces flew overhead, because they had to establish a bridgehead on the far bank before we could get our tanks across on pontoons. Although I didn't know it at the time, one of the big Horser towing many gliders behind it was being piloted by an old college friend of mine. I didn't discover that fact until we met many years after the war.
But the Germans were sniping and shelling at you at this point. It was quite dangerous, quite tricky.
Well, as I say, we eventually had a cushy crossing of the Rhine because the airborne had built up a bridgehead for us on the far side. But of course, as we advanced very slowly through Germany, we had unpleasant situations, especially going through towns where you would often be sniped.
I remember one particular evening you were talking to a chap, you were just sort of, before you went to bed, talking to him. Being a countryman, he was a countryman.
Yes.
It was an unfortunate and very sad event, wasn't it?
We used to leaguer every night. All the tanks would form up a square and the lorries would come up with petrol and ammunition and food. One of my pals came across one evening to join me for a chat by my tank. And he was a countryman, like me, and I remember we were discussing the best way to set a snare to catch a rabbit. After our chat, he returned to his tank and was killed by a shell that dropped in the Liga during the night.
Now, the regiment is given orders to reach the Baltic coast, some 80 miles away, and get there as quickly as possible. Why was that? Why did you have to go to the Baltic?
Well, we crossed, as I say, we crossed slowly through Germany until we finally reached the River Elbe. And there we were given orders to make a mad dash to the north to reach the Baltic coast to cut off the Russians from getting into Denmark.
And you have a bit of a story on the way to Wismar.
Yes, I shall never forget that last day of the war. At one point I stopped and pulled down a large German Nazi flag, which I took home as one of my trophies. I advanced mostly along country tracks while the regiment was going up the main road. At one point, a vehicle which looked like a school bus pulled out of a side track in front of me. Through my field glasses, I could see German uniforms inside. So I fired a few bursts and brought it to a standstill, and found that inside were Germans escorting American Air Force prisoners of war westwards. So we relieved the Germans of their weapons, gave them to the Americans and left them to get on with it.
They wouldn't know what to do with a rifle, would they?
They weren't very happy. Okay. So I advanced towards Wismar. At one point I remember passing a big German farm. It was built in the form of a rectangle, and as I looked through the open gates I could see a whole German regiment drawn up in drill order waiting to surrender. But my commanding officer was urging me to get on as fast as I could, and so I ignored them and drove northwards.
Right. And there is a story when you approach the level crossing.
At one point I reached a level crossing, and halted across it was a complete German troop train carrying hundreds of soldiers and weapons, tanks, etc., on flat cars. I called up my CO and told him what I had found, but he told me not to shoot it up, as it might block the road and stop the regiment from advancing. So on I went.
All right. As you approached Wismar, you saw aircraft.
Yes. I approached Wismar. By then, my commanding officer, Colonel Dougie Stewart, had come up behind me, also in a honey tank, and we could see German aircraft landing somewhere across the town. We drove through the town and found the airfield right on the Baltic coast. So we drove on to the airfield, took a few shots at the Messerschmitts as they tried to land, and rounded up all the Luftwaffe personnel and got them marching off where they could be escorted away by the infantry. And it was then, of course, that the regiment fired the last shots of the war. Colonel Dougie fired at a lorry load of Germans trying to escape, and I potted at a German creeping up with a Panzerfaust. And so he didn't fire the Panzerfaust.
So that was the end of it, was it?
And that was the end of the war for the Greys. It had been a long journey, which had started 3 years earlier at the Battle of Alamein.
And so the RSG, the Royal Scots Greys, moved back then, did they?
When the war finished, yes, we moved back inland, were billeted on a German farm, and the first thing we did was to round up a bunch of German horses, which we used to ride out every day, go for a swim in one of the lakes, and ride back again. Life was pleasant indeed.
And there's one story when you were riding down the road riding a mare.
Yes. I was out riding with my pal Louis Muirhead one day through a German village, riding a couple of nice mares, when suddenly there was a loud whinny and a stallion galloped out from a barn and tried to mount the mare on which I was riding.
That didn't make it too easy for you then, did it?
It was a very unique experience, you might say.
You were all pretty good horsemen, obviously, in the RSG. And one particular guy, Douglas Stewart, did very well, didn't he?
Yes, our commanding officer was a very brilliant horseman. In fact, he was the only man to win 2 Olympic gold medals, one for show jumping and one for eventing.
So now, Jeremy, you start to make your way home by lorry, I think, to Dieppe. And once home, you're back to Catterick.
Yes, I eventually got a month's leave under a scheme called the Python Scheme, and had a month's leave at home, and then went back to Catterick Camp on my way back to rejoin the regiment. But while at Catterick, there came through what was called B Release. It was an early release scheme for school teachers who were needed back in the war, in the schools. I deliberated, shall I go back to the regiment or shall I go back to civilian life? I knew that peacetime soldiering would not be like wartime soldiering. Secondly, I had married during my brief period back in the UK and had a small daughter, and so I took B release and returned to civilian life.
So you came back to school?
So I came back to Chesham and taught in local schools there, first as an ordinary class teacher, then I became a deputy headmaster.
One excellent piece of news, which you hadn't counted on, was something waiting for you, a letter from the War Office that had been sent to your mother and father.
Yes, when I got back home, I found out that my parents had received a letter from the War Office to say that I had been mentioned in dispatches. It's above my mantelpiece to your right at this moment.
So you came through 6 years of active war service and survived?
Indeed. I was one of the lucky chaps who didn't have a scratch. But, of course, 100 of my comrades did not come back. I still have very close contact with the regiment. Every November I go up to Edinburgh, where our war memorial is, and we have a little parade there in Prince's Street Gardens. And then, of course, we retire to a British Legion club for money a wee dram.
And on that note, we say thank you, Mr. Randall.